Blog Talk Radio.
Our community have become toxic waste. Those in high places are planning to remove the toxic waste. And while we flitter and live this frivolous, foolish life, seeking pleasure from our bodies and pleasure from the bodies of others, and seeking to be famous and wealthy in this world, to be used by the power to make our people think that if you go to school and work hard, you too can be successful. That's a lie. I don't give a damn how many of you go to school and work hard. They select a few out of the mass to deceive the rest that this house is not your house. And you are going to have to think about a house of your own, because white America, listen to me good, man, cannot support you any longer. White America cannot give jobs to her millions of unemployed, much less ours. Did you hear me? Elijah Muhammad told us in the 60s we should pool our resources and get farmland, because there is no freedom without land. You remember those teachings? He said that the time of separation had come, and that we are going to have to think about building a nation of our own. You, in the 60s, you were ready to say it's nation time. You don't say that no more, because you have been deceived into thinking that inclusion into this is your salvation. This that you want to be included in has no future. None.
Greetings and assalamu alaikum. Welcome to tonight's edition of the Time to Leave Blog Talk Radio Show. We are looking forward to another exciting special show tonight. Tonight, our farm manager and organizer of the Time to Leave movement, Dr. Rijdi Abdul Mumin Muhammad, will be interviewing our brother Eric Simpson of the West Georgia Farmers Cooperative. And I see that Dr. Rijdi is in the queue. I'm going to open his mic. Assalamu alaikum, Dr. Rijdi.
Wa alaikum salam. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. How you doing this evening?
I'm fine. And you?
Oh, I had a hard day's work in somebody's house redoing their bathroom.
You made quite a mess. But other than that, no, you did great, bro. You're doing fine. Just kidding. Just kidding, everybody out there. He's great. He's great. Okay.
Communal humor, huh?
Yeah, communal humor, whatever, you know, just not originally messing with people again, you know, whatever. But we really appreciate you and what you're doing, helping us out here in the woods. It's hard to get people to come out here to do any work.
Yes, sir. Yep. Yes, sir. I found that out in my house, too, for stuff that I can't do.
Yep. So being in the country does have advantages and disadvantages.
It does.
So, is Brother Eric on the line yet?
Brother Eric, if you are on the line, press the 1 on your dial so that you can come to the top of the queue and I can open your mic. I have a phone number for him from the previous show. I don't see it here. If you are on, Brother Eric, press the 1 on your dial, and that would light up your line, and I can open your mic, Brother Eric.
Yeah, I just talked to him, so he should be
Did he have a 707, 706 number?
Yeah, 706 number.
Yes, sir. He's not on yet.
Not on yet? He just said he was dial right in.
Press the 1 on your dial, Brother Eric. And I don't see a 706.
Okay. He says he'll call right in. I give him a minute or two. Let me text him again. You know, one thing about we farmers, we have to multitask. Let's see here. I got to send the number plain text. Okay, let me, Brother Carl, give me the number, because I'm, what's the number?
The number I have for him is 706.
No. The number for Blog Talk. I got to type it in.
Oh, the number for Blog Talk is 563-999-3656.
Okay. Yeah, I tried to share it. You know how you share it number and
yes, sir.
Text it to him with the share, but somehow or another it didn't come up to him for him. He said, so I had to do it plain text.
Yes, sir.
So now it'll come up and he'll be able to call in.
Good.
But yeah, he I'm working with him. He's the head of this this co-op they're developing, and up in LaGrange, Georgia, which is about 30 minutes north of Columbus, Georgia,
mm-hmm.
and 25 minutes north of Columbus, Georgia, which is not too far away for us to do business. What people don't understand, they say, why don't they set up co-ops? Well, generally, co-ops, the farmers live within a county or two. They live within 30 or 40 miles of each other, so that collecting the product and getting product shipped collectively is feasible. We wanted to set up, when the Black Farmers lawsuit, we had the beef chapter here in Georgia, and we did a survey about where the farmers were located, and there was 100 farmers, and it was in about 25 or 30 counties. That means there's only one or two, three farmers in a county, and they all spread out all over Georgia.
Wow.
And so to try to do a co-op, because then you got to have, with a co-op, you got to have the same, some products, you know what I mean? In other words, usually they do, the way they do it is they do, you know, squash, or they do watermelons, or they do corn. You know, in other words, the co-op is to move a certain product, and a number of farmers produce a lot of that, and they put it together.
Mm-hmm.
You got to get coordinated in terms of the crops you're going to grow. So he's trying to work that out within a region here, Brother Eric is, because it's kind of hard to work it out for the whole state. So he's trying to work it out for region, and we're close enough that we can participate, but it's still a challenge because it's still between me and him, it's still about an hour and 20 minutes, which is how it is, just an hour and 20 minutes. Well, that's hour and 20 one way, hour and 20 back. That's 3 hours.
Right.
Okay? And for a farmer, 3 hours in the daytime is a tremendous amount of time, because in terms of
yes,
what
sir.
You could be doing in that time frame. Did he pop up yet?
Now, Brother Eric, if you are on the line, please press 1 on your phone so that you can recognize you in the queue. And there he is. Let's see.
Okay, great.
Is this Brother Eric?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. We hear you now.
Okay. All right.
Yes,
can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
Can you hear me?
We
okay.
We cool. I was just telling Brother Carlson in the listening audience that people don't understand that black farmers need to get together and set up a co-op. Well, most co-ops operate within 30, 40 miles of each other. In other words, the farmers are in usually the same county or a couple of counties, you know, but trying to work a co-op all over the state is problematic because you can't get your products together and to get processed or shipped. But you are developing one in West Georgia, West Central Georgia, which is not too far from us. It's an hour and 20 minutes, but still, an hour and 20 minutes is a lot for a farmer in the daytime because of the work he has to do. So it's problematic, but we're going to try to make it happen. Then you got to coordinate the crops so that they fit and so that the things come in on schedules. And so it's very, very problematic. And then you are also doing training to help us to be able to fit in to that system. So, Brother Eric, how long have you been working on the co-op, and where you at now?
Well, our co-op is actually established. Our co-op, West Georgia Farm, which is West Georgia Farmers Co-op, we were established in 1966. So we've already, we already exist. And to your point, as far as proximity, as far as producers. That's more as time has evolved. Of course, initially when our co-op first started, yes, a lot of our farmers and families lived all, you know, fairly in fairly close proximity there in Harris County, you know, of course, in Talbot County. And so probably maybe, you know, 100% of them all lived within like 30 miles of each other. And this was like in the late 60s, early 70s. But however, you know, of course, as our farmers have, as we've lost farmers over the years, naturally our farmers are further apart. So we address that challenge by, of course, you know, the gap there is logistics. And so, of course, and that figures into your pricing and the way you pick up, and you know the way we compensate for that, because we have farmers, we still live fairly close within each other. I mean, within fairly reasonable proximity. Of course, our central location is Hamilton, Georgia. There at our co-op building, I live in West Point, which is in 30 minutes of the co-op's headquarters. And most of our farmers live probably, and when I say most, I'm only talking about three or four that live in close proximity. But we have farmers as far away as Fort Valley. Coming in your direction, we've got a farmer down in Webster County in Preston, Georgia. We have a farmer over in Tuskegee. But, of course, that's compensated with pricing. And of course, you know, as a co-op, we share in the responsibilities of the logistics. So the principle of cooperative economics is sharing. And so farmers will sometimes bring their produce to the central location, and sometimes we will send someone to harvest for them just to accommodate the farmers you were mentioning earlier, Dr. Muhammad, about travel time being away from the farm. So it's very rare that our farmers will have to travel to bring product to us. We will either meet them halfway or we will go all the way and maybe meet them in a location near where they live, so they won't have to spend almost 3 hours away from the farm. So, but what we're doing, we're actually not building another cooperative. We are a cooperative that's practicing principle number six of cooperative economics, which is cooperation among cooperatives. There are some other cooperatives that are already formed that we're working with to get products from. And then there are some growers and producers that are not co-ops, but they are black. And so our priority as far as the supply source for this retail outlet that we're building is, of course, black farmers, producers, value-added producers, manufacturers. That's priority number one. Priority number two, black cooperatives. And then priority number three, local you know, start all over again, local producers, local cooperatives, local value-added people, because we're building a retail outlet that will provide a home for people like us and people that have mm-hmm. local products that maybe we don't have. And so that's what we're building, just for a sense of distinction. You know, our cooperative is 54 years old, will be 55 come July of this, of 2021. And so, but we're building a retail enterprise that will source products, you know, whether it's fresh veggies, meats, honey, some of your grain products there at Muhammad Farms. We have a fisherman's co-op that we're working with that's going to supply us a lot of our seafood. We've got a beef cattle cooperative of a black cooperative that's there in East Georgia. And so that's what we're attempting to accomplish. So we're still cooperating, but the cooperative is the one that's kind of leading this whole organization effort.
Okay, well, I guess what I should have said is how you come in with the store project, the actual retail
exactly.
outlet project.
No doubt, no doubt. And I was about to transition to that, and thank you for allowing me to transition, to setting me up to transition to that. Well, the target is December 31st of 2022. As I mentioned earlier, we've got our suppliers pretty much committed. I sent out, well, and I can talk to you about that later. But yes, so we have suppliers committed, and we have done the market studies. We've done the construction rendering, and we are still in campaign. We're still in capitalization mode. So we're in the process of raising the money through co-op owner shares primarily to capitalize the amount of money that we need to build this out. And we're giving ourselves to 2022 to do that. And we're off to a fairly brisk start. You know, we've been able to grow our member base, and we've been able to convert a lot of those members into owners. So our owner base is growing as well. And so, mm-hmm. yes, due to COVID, we haven't been able to get out into the various communities to do some of the presentations, but we have been doing some of these same trainings and presentations via Zoom as mm-hmm. of late. We've been working with a lot of the value added producers like our sauce makers and acidified products makers, and so we're going to continue those series of regulatory and safety trainings to come back around to our farmers and livestock producers.
Okay, well, you got quite a bit on your plate. Now the I'm just interested, the fish. What type of fish do they do the fish? Because you know we
yes.
eat fish. Or what type
right.
of fish do they catch?
Oh yes, they fish primarily on the Atlantic coast, and of course, and one of them is from Louisiana, so they'll go down to the bayou, but they go all the way up as far as Maine sometimes, but primarily they fish whiting, they fish shrimp, they fish oysters and some blue crab, and so that's their primary products.
Okay. Well, I'm definitely interested in the whiting.
Okay, yes, yes. Matter of fact, I spoke to Brother Carlton about it a couple of weeks ago when I came there to pick up some product, and I was expecting a catch, but of course, something came up that week, and I think one of the guys had COVID, and so they didn't get a chance to go out. But the captain of one of the boats contacted me last week, so he's out on the waters now. He was going to be gone for about a week, so he should be coming back to dock probably this weekend. And so, once I go and meet with him and get the product, I'll stop through that way, because I'm sure I may have to come that route anyway. So, I'm looking forward to it as well.
Okay. Well, great. I mean, you know, this whole thing of getting started and getting things coordinated, you know, you're dealing with, you know, people used to, you know, oh, I think I want me some for some fish. I'm going to go down here to Walmart 2 o'clock in the morning and buy some fish. And, you know, in other words, they use the things that are so convenient for them. They, you know, they don't know what it takes to try to compete with what's so convenient. So we can't do things as quickly and conveniently. Like I tell people, we're not Amazon, you know what I mean? We can't drop, you know, your package off to your doorstep. You know, we can't send you a 5-pound bag of flour, okay? I mean, we don't do that. So to try to get them coordinated and get people organized and disciplined to be able to wait and be patient so that we can deliver to them, so we can give them a great product at a fair price. It's not easy. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine, you know, I was telling him we out here planting wheat, you know, that we're going to make into the flour and the cream of wheat and the muffin mix. And he said, what's the big deal? Just to go out there and, you know, drop a couple of seeds in the ground. I mean that's what's hard about that? Well, when you're trying to do 300-400 acres and you got to do it all within 1 month, you know, you got to put it in the ground within 1 month. Ain't like you ain't got all year to put it in the ground. And so that's where the problem comes, is when you're trying to do large volumes and nature has time constraints. You just can't do it when you want to do it. You got to do it when she say do it, and you got to get it all done when she say get it all done. If not, you don't get nothing. You know what I mean? So it's not that easy on the production end, and then you're trying to coordinate production and then marketing timing with other farmers. And you know, it's a lot to it. You know, and people think farming, oh, it's just go out there and stick it in. Well, yeah, you can grow a pot of tomatoes, you know, one pot of tomatoes. But whatever, you trying to do 5 acres of tomatoes? That's a whole different ball game. So you know, it's a challenge. And then when the black farmers, when we did have our market, you know, we had schools, we had our own hospitals, we had restaurants because we couldn't go to eat the white folks' restaurants. We had restaurants and people were cooking at home. So we had, you know, farmers can bring them, you know, go through with a pickup truck on a weekend with the vegetables and everything. People were cooking. But now people, COVID-19 making people go back in the house and cook. But for a long time, the integration, we can go to eat the white man's restaurants, we can go to his grocery stores. We didn't have to cook. We get stuff prefab food, you know. So it was like, you know, and the black farmers lost their market. Not the black farmers couldn't grow, but they lost their market. And now we are trying to get it back. So I appreciate your effort in trying to get this all together.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. You know, we appreciate you all for working with us and being willing to go on this journey with us, because it's going to take all of us, you know, because like I said, we're starting something hopefully that we can replicate and duplicate in other places, and we can start the larger objective is food sovereignty and to regain the control of the economics of our community, as the picture that you was painting from, you know, from decades ago.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we had it going on and didn't know it. You know what I'm talking about?
But exactly. Somebody else,
yeah, we was that was life. That's where we lived. But somebody else, and it under segregation, we had figured out a way to develop some independent economics. Okay, on our side of town. But then people say,
exactly.
Well, hey, we want that money too. So they set up. So they set up these malls and they let us come in the restaurants. Why? Because they wanted our money. It wasn't because they liked us. It's that they saw that we was going to survive and make money, eat well and dress well without them. And they didn't like that. So they wanted to get our money. So that's what they did. So they opened up the door, and we went and gave them everything. And then they started treating us worse and worse and worse. We started dying from being, you know, dying from bad food. And now we realize, hey, we got to feed ourselves. But now we got to start a process all over again that we let that slip out of our fingers. We didn't know the importance of it, you know, but now we do. But who's going to do the work? And everybody's so soft and so lazy and so content and so looking at football and search for tomorrow that nobody want to get out there and break their nails and get their shoes dirty or drive up and down the road to try to coordinate things with people, because they, you know, they got the, hey, I got my life. Yeah, you're dying in that life, okay? But you ain't got no time to help us build another one, okay?
Yeah.
But we really appreciate what you're doing, Brother Eric, and like, you know, we want to participate in that, put some product in, and get some product out, you know, from the system, because I'm just tired of being a slave to this man's system.
Yeah.
You know, we got to have our own.
We have to. That's the only way forward. You know, we must control the economics, our own economic destiny, or forever be at the mercy of others.
That's right. And so one thing about COVID-19 is just about scared us to death. I should say to life, because we're doing some lively things now. I mean, our last staple of goods, we sold more product than we ever did. It just wore me out physically. Try to move all that stuff for me, really. But it was all because of COVID-19. So we come up with staple goods 20, and we don't know what it's going to be like, you know. But now they talk about it trying to have a lockdown again. So, you know, I don't know what that's going to bring, but it's evident that we need to pull out and do something for ourselves, because right now there ain't no benefit being hooked up in this system. Okay?
Not at all.
No money, and now you scared to even go outside the house. Now what's that?
Exactly.
Somebody being segregated. You can't be segregated. You can't even go outside the house. How segregated is that? I don't know about separation. That sounds like segregation to me. Well, you can't even go outside your house. What about that?
Right. But yeah, I concur. This COVID period has been somewhat of a mixed blessing. A lot of small farmers have prospered like never before, because for the reason that people are trying to, were more conscious during this period of trying to source food without, you know, risking being around a lot of people to get it. So I'm glad to know that you all were able to benefit like we were. Of course, you know, unfortunately, you know, of course it was in these circumstances, but, you know, we can't predict, you know, what tomorrow is going to bring. We just, like you said, we just get out there and work and do the best we can and just wait for those opportunities when they come.
I tell this story about a friend of ours, young sister, and she went to school for, I think it was culinary, not for, if my wife, if she can, anyway, something to do with nutrition, okay, she got a degree in that. And she works with, you know, with black farmers. But she didn't even have a pot in her house to cook in, you know what I mean? But now she's actually cooking, you know what I mean?
Yes.
And like, wow, that's great. But, yeah, now people are actually cooking now instead of going out to the restaurants, because the restaurants are closed down. So, you know, it was a mixed blessing, you know. But, you know, we kind of thank COVID-19 for that. And now, of course, they're trying to get us to take this vaccine, but, you know, we don't need a vaccine. Just be clean and get you some vitamin D, vitamin C, some Listerine, gargle it. You know what I mean? It's a bad flu. That's all it is. A flu will kill you, but you know, COVID ain't no worse than that. But they pump it up because they want to take that vaccine. But at least some of the people are going back to studying, and also going back to home remedies, reading up on home remedies again, and that brings it back into herbs and stuff like that. So things going to open up. The holistic stuff go open up. Now it's going to be, you know, possibility for herb farmers, you know, to grow herbs for people. So now people are not trusting the system, and they shouldn't trust it. They should not trust the system. So now that's going to open up. So, yeah, it's interesting. And people leaving the cities. Have you had any people come in your area that's moved out of big cities lately?
Well, I've been getting a lot of, strangely that you should mention that, I'm getting a lot of requests from friends that I know in Atlanta that are looking for property out here, that are looking to move to areas like out here. So, yes, they haven't, many of them haven't moved yet, but they seem to be planning to do so. So I'm sure that's in no small part to some of the issues that they've been having in these cities, you know.
Yeah, you get shot at, and now somebody want to shoot you up. You know,
shot at with a gun and I didn't want to shoot you up with a needle, yeah, it's time to leave. It's time to leave. That's why we call it time to leave.
Yes.
So, Brother Calder, any questions online? Open up questions. You want to ask a question to Brother Eric?
Well, not at this time. I think they might be kind of shy. Brothers and sisters, if you're enjoying the show and you have a question or comment that you'd like to make or request, the one you dial, you'll be entered into our speaking queue and you'll be recognized immediately. So press the one you dial if you have a question or you want to make a comment about tonight's show.
Okay. So while we're waiting on those questions, anything else, Brother Eric, that you would like to highlight about your activities and what y'all doing?
Sure. And I'm not sure if I copied you all on the email or if you may have seen it on our social media, but we were just awarded a very special national award. We were awarded the 100 food. We were awarded the food purveyor of the year by the 100 Good Food List restaurants. And that's an organization of farm-to-table, of high-end farm-to-table chefs. And that award was granted to us on November the 24th, the Good Food 100 restaurants. We were granted the Farm and Purveyor of the Year, the Purveyors of the Year. This is an award that they only give, they award it to farmers and, like, food purveyors, like distributors, food hubs, people such as that. And so, and it's one per region. So we were given this award for the Southeast region. So we were pretty proud about that. So yeah, that's in those that want to see it, it's on our Facebook page.
So you supplied some high end restaurants up in Atlanta, right?
Yes, sir. That's been part of our customer base for about the last 3 years, and two of the restaurants that we serve that we sell to are part of this group, and one of them nominated us, and these are restaurants that have James Beard Award winning chefs, and these are some of the most high end food crafters in the business, and of course Atlanta's fortunate enough. Atlanta has over 100 farm to table restaurants. And this is a group of food entrepreneurs who really value local food. They value growers that grow naturally and sustainably clean food, you know, whether it's organic or naturally grown or whatever the case may be, you know, growing without any harsh chemicals or pesticides or synthetic fertilizers. That's who they source from, and we just happen to be one of the farmer groups that's been selling to them for a couple of years. And, of course, delivering quality products and quality good service, you know, of course, somebody took notice of it and decided to nominate us. And we're thankful for that.
Wow. I'm really proud of y'all, man. I'm proud of y'all, man. That's great. I mean, it ain't that we can't do it. We can do it. And if you do it right, you know, people go pay you and recognize, but you gotta know how to carve your market out. I mean, you know, you all went after that market. That high end market and produce what they needed when they needed it, et cetera. And so that fit in. But you know, you got to do your homework. You know, and it ain't gonna just come to you. You got to go to it.
Right. And that's one of the benefits of being in progressive cooperatives that are trying to identify, locate, and even in some cases build niches. And so.
Niche markets.
Find niches.
Explain to people better what that means. What's a
niche
market?
It's a small piece of a larger market. Just like, for instance, where in the large market, just you would say restaurants, right? That's like all of your franchises, like Wendy's, like Golden Corral, like Longhorns. But then you have farm-to-table restaurants. That's a niche market. There's only a few farm-to-table restaurants that exist and most of them, and there's few that exist outside of Atlanta in Georgia. Most of the ones that I'm familiar with are in Atlanta. Like I said, Atlanta's blessed to have about 100, anywhere from 100 to 200 of these types of restaurants. There's about 4 in Columbus. And then out of those restaurants, you have to find the ones that need the particular products that you sell. So the fact that you already have an entrepreneur base and a customer base that shares your values, where, you know, most restaurants, you know, they're just looking for, I mean, they're a business. They're looking to get the cheapest products, the best products for the cheapest price so they can mark up. Well, these particular restaurants, because they share our values, very seldom do we haggle over prices because, for one, they don't buy in large bulk. They don't buy a lot of quantity, but they buy it often enough and putting a few of these together. Now, where if you're just selling, one farmer can probably sell to one of these restaurants because, like I said, these restaurants, they cater to a high-end clientele. You know, of course, if you take your wife to one of these restaurants, if you get a 6-course meal, you're going to spend $200. Definitely going to spend $150.
Okay, back up. I don't want my wife to hear that, though. But say that again.
yes, you're going to spend anywhere from $150 to $200 on a 6-course meal at a restaurant like this. But the people that patronize these restaurants, they are willing to spend that kind of money to eat this locally grown, high organic, in most cases, or naturally grown food. And knowing that it's coming from, you know, farmers in Georgia, or in some cases, some of it even comes from some of the urban farms in Atlanta. But the value of the cooperative model is because even one farmer, you're going to run out of food at some point in time. But, of course,
right,
with more than one farmer, you know, we can keep the supply going as long as they have a need for it. And then when you put several of these restaurants together, now you have a market. Now you have some customers that will buy your food at an above average price because, you know, their customers don't mind if they go up $1, you know, on their bowl of kale, or if they go up $2 on their squash medley, they'll pay it because people that are coming to these restaurants, they are expecting to pay a king's ransom anyway for a meal. And of course, that may not work for your because we also sell to a local buffet restaurant here in my city. They're black owned. They're good people. And matter of fact, the gentlelady who's the proprietor, she used to be Gladys Knight's personal chef. But her and her family, they have a buffet restaurant, and we don't sell to them that often. But we have a relationship. I can tell her you'd like if we've got something. You know, she'll typically buy it. And what she loves to buy the rutabaga greens, you know, because a lot of our people don't realize that the greens of rutabagas are fairly delicious and nutritious. They look like a fine collard. She craves them, you know, she'll cook them just straight and then let her people know after they eat them because they'll think that they're eating collards and they say, yeah, these are so good. Well, those rutabaga greens, honey. Oh, yeah, I've been eating rutabagas. We didn't fool with the greens. You know, to get that kind of conversation to come. And then sometimes she'll blend them, you know, with the collards and turnips. So that's an example of a niche market. Another example of a niche market is, for instance, I have laying hens. And so and there are certain times of the year I just have a glut of eggs, and more than often I can sell at the farmer's market. But due to the fact that I have some business relationships with some local bakeries, and then there's local bakers even within my co-op, I can sell my eggs that I can't sell retail, you know, at the farmer's market. I can sell them to these bakeries. And, of course, and they use them to bake their value-added products, you know, their pies and donuts or whatever, you know, whatever they're using. So those are examples of niche markets.
I'm going to come over there and see your chicken operation. I've been, you know, looking in to try to do something, if I get some labor to help me do it, you know, people say, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? Well, hey, you know, it requires labor that you can depend on. But I saw some, I'm going to send a picture of something. I saw some on the side of the road at a farmer's house there. He has some chickens using 5 gallon buckets, 55 gallon drums. I had never seen that before. And he had a string tied to their feet that's tied to the top so they can only walk around within a certain distance, but they could be in their free range. You know what I mean? They walk around.
Right.
I didn't see what was inside the 55-gallon drum, how they got it set up in there for each one of the chickens. But I just thought that was in. I'll send you a picture of it. Maybe have you seen
sure.
that before? Oh, yeah. Okay, well, cool.
Yeah. Now, my chicken operation is fairly simple. I've just got free-range birds. And of course, and they can range free because they've got protection. I've got dogs, you know, that I use for my, you know, to guard my livestock, to guard my sheep and goats, and so they can pretty much live and eat and range pretty comfortably because this place is for the most part predator proof, and that's important when you're trying to free range laying hens because, you know, your prices have to take into account that, you know, you're going to lose some birds, you know, to various predators, hawks and foxes. But I've got some good dogs that aren't lazy. Now I've had some lazy dogs in the past, and every now and then a fox will snatch one that ranges a bit too far, you know, that gets over in the thickets, and because and it really benefits me because I don't have to buy feed as much because they're getting everything they need. That's exactly the way nature intended. They're getting grass, they're getting bugs, they're getting worms.
Right.
And it's showing, and it comes out in the egg that you eat, and so, and it's a pretty low cost operation, and it's good for many ways because I mean I hadn't purchased a store bought egg since I've been on this farm, and I came out to this farm in 2012, and I started, and I got my hens in about 2013, so I hadn't really bought a. I hadn't had a store-bought egg in over 7 years, and so
wow.
But yeah, so
well, you know,
so yes.
One of the things that happened with the Black Farmers lawsuit is, in the past we had subsistence farming, and then we had excess. Then we have a cash crop, but then we also have subsistence farming. So let's say we were growing cotton or we were growing peanuts. We also would have a milk operation or a chicken operation or egg operation type of thing or sheep on the side so that can provide for the home and also you sell, you know, sell some eggs or some birds when you need the cash money so you don't have to borrow money. But then when the Black farmers try to get into going into what they call agribusiness or, you know, agribusiness, and they wanted to do commodities, you know, large scale production of commodities. Then the USDA forced them to give up those small operations to just to concentrate on the big operation. So now they had to borrow money for inputs because they don't have the little hog operation or your little chicken operation or your little cow operation. You don't have that, and now you got to borrow everything that you need, and you got to go and buy food for the home. So it put them at jeopardy, and then they wind up, USDA took the land. So now, you know, you need to be able to do something for yourself, not just grow commodities a large scale and find you a niche market, but also grow something for yourself and your family so that then you can get the benefit on living off the land instead of you just being a servant to the system and borrowing money to survive. And working like the devil to try to pay off those loans and all that type of stuff. So there's a lot to be learned in terms of how to survive. People who are doing it can help people. And being a part of a co-op, you learn things. I mean, you know, you learn things from other farmers.
Yes.
And this helps you out a whole lot because farmers will tell you stuff, you know, because we don't mind telling people stuff because we know either you're going to do it or you ain't going to do it. And most time people ain't going to do it no way. They just talking. But farmers go do it, and that's enough room for everybody. You know what I mean? But
But yeah, you need to be a part of a co-op to learn some more things from somebody who know what they're doing.
Yes, yes. And to your point, you mentioned something that I heard today on a Zoom call that I was participating in about racial equity, and we were talking about the plight of the black farmer, and one of my colleagues emphasized that simple point that you touched on just a few seconds ago as far as the priority of the things that a black farmer should grow, and he made the point that, you know, first when we black farmers always understood that your first priority is you growing enough food to what feed your family. That's the first thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no reason a farmer should be a farmer and depending on food stamps for livelihood, because he
right.
should be growing food to feed his family. And then because you grow so much, obviously your family don't need to eat everything on 5 or 10 acres. So now you got enough and you sell enough food for other folks that don't farm to feed their families. And that's
mm-hmm.
kind of the way it was prioritized. And so and there's a documentary, if you get a chance to see it, it's well worth the view. It's called King Corn. And it emphasizes the commodification of corn, you know, especially in the Midwest where a lot of the corn comes from, Illinois, Iowa, and all of those places where you just, as far as you can see, is corn. You know that it's much of that corn, it's much time and energy and fuel and land that it takes to grow that corn. That corn, that farmer can't even feed that corn to his family. He can't even put it on his dinner table. Because it's so genetically modified, and doesn't really have any human consumption value, that you know it's just so to feed his family. He's still got to go buy corn from the grocery store.
Listen to that. Isn't that a something? They
yes,
they,
yes.
They're made slaves. As a farmer, and now the farmers are digging their graves because now the prices have gone down so low on those commodities and the cost of production to keep going up for those inputs to where they are a slave, and they just some of them commit suicide. I mean, you know, they're running them to the
yes.
ground. They're running the farmers into the ground, literally. You
yes.
know? And it's hard when you already got, you know, thousands of acres and you strung out, you know what I mean? And you don't want to step back because then, you know, it looks like you're a loser. So you step back,
yeah.
you know what I mean? And so they just keep pushing,
yeah.
pushing, pushing until they break.
Oh, yes, yes.
So we want the young people to study, but, you know, don't get caught up in this agribusiness thing where you go try to make a whole lot of money, try to do a bunch of acres of stuff, because now you really are controlled by the whole system. You got to have your own. This is what I was trying to get the black farmers to understand. Once we come out this lawsuit, then what we should do is set up a co-op, put money in and set up a co-op. But what happened was they didn't give the black farmers who they did get money to, they didn't give it to us at one time. So they gave it to people over a 10-year period, eating, meaning, mighty mo, and never in the same family in the same time. So we couldn't put our money together to do anything with it collectively. Everybody's wind up spending and buying them a Silverado pickup truck. There wasn't enough money to buy a tractor. Okay? And now the money gone, you know. But they knew what they was doing when they set up the lawsuit. They knew what they was doing when they got us to go into this called agribusiness and commodity production. They knew what they was doing. And we got took. So now we got to develop. That's why get involved with a co-op. We have our own retail outlet for our products with our brands on it. That we have our own customer base and not depend on somebody else, so they can tell us, no, well, we don't need your product right now. Because that's what they did to in the past. You think you have a contract with a grocery, say a grocery chain or a restaurant chain, and then all of a sudden they tell you, oh, your product did not meet specifications. Now, what happened was they were able to get it cheaper. And so to get out of paying you because you made a contract, they'll tell you that your product did not meet specifications and then how to get out of that contract. And you can't take them to court because the product is already spoiled because it's you know, it don't last. I mean, it's a fresh product. Yes. We got a question?
We got a caller.
Okay, great. Let's put the call on.
Caller with the last four digits, 5597. What's your name and where are you calling from?
As-salamu alaykum. My name is Sister Kim Muhammad, and I'm calling from St. Louis, Missouri.
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
I'm really enjoying this about the farming and everything, and when you all were speaking about self and leading others, I was thinking about how my mom used to make biscuits, and then they started selling them for 10 cents, and she stopped putting the natural ingredients that we had in the house all at the same time, flour and butter, and she just stopped because she can get it for 10 cents a can. And now she lost the knowledge of how to make biscuits down the years. So these tricks are what they get away with forever with our people. And so it's got to be a way that we can teach the knowledge as we learn our lesson and keep it going, you know, on to future generations, because they get away with so much through tricknology, and so their time is up. So we have to unify. We got to close that gap and do what we need to do. But I'm really enjoying the former and Dr. Ridgely. Thank you. I enjoying your program.
Well, thank you, Sister Kim. And you just reminded me of something as well with that. When I was growing up, I used to stay at the Moore's house because my mother worked at night. And I would stay with the Moore's family, you know, elderly couple. And she made this marble cake. Mm-hmm. I did not know that that's the only marble cake in the world like that. I did not know that that was the best marble cake in the world. I did not know. I know I loved it, but I did not know until now she's passed, and I didn't learn how to make it. And I have never seen or tasted another marble cake. That thing could sit there for 2 weeks underneath her cover. And it still be as moist as it was. She baked it. It's how she did that, I don't know. And then lost it. It went with her to the grave, and I didn't pick it up because I didn't know the value of it. So that on so many things, that's what happened with us, is that we just did not know the value of these things until we lost it. So now we're trying to separate and try to regain ourselves and learn how to do things for ourselves and trade with each other. And then how to produce the things that we used to know how to produce, but we didn't know the value of it. And he came, gave us something cheaper and supposedly better and cheaper, and we went for the okey-doke, and now we got to start all over again. But maybe Allah will give us some time to get through and to get some of these things to get started again. So thank you so much, Sister Kim, about that biscuit, that information, because that just reminded me about that marble cake. So, anybody else, Brother Carlton?
Not at this time.
Yeah, and I'll just and on her comment about losing some of the old ways as far as cooking and recipes, that just allows me to segue into another aspect of the project that will be part of the part of the work that we're doing. There's a shared kitchen component that will also be attached to the grocery store. And that shared kitchen is a shared commercial kitchen that will serve two purposes. It's going to serve as an incubator for local culinary entrepreneurs to have a commercial kitchen that they can get licensed in, and they can create products that they can sell, for one, and maybe even create products that we can market and brand and sell, you know, in the grocery store itself. And also, the plan is to have some community usage, and in that community usage, there will be programs, there will be cooking classes, and one particular class that we've kind of identified as a special West Georgia project is homestead economics. Homestead economics seeks to save and pass down some of those old food ways and recipes and, you know, canning methods and, you know, just a lot of the old home economics skills that a lot of our mothers and grandmothers and great-grandmothers had, you know, years ago in order to get people back to cooking, because as Dr. Muhammad was speaking about a few minutes ago, you know, of course, this pandemic has got people back in the kitchen, And that's a good thing. Being a part of a local food system, creating local food systems, is creating this term that we call slow food. And slow food is just that. It's the opposite of fast food. Fast food was created for convenience because women were starting to go to work, and they needed, and they still needed to make dinner for the husband and Junior and Molly. And so the TV dinner was brought onto the scene. And then, of course, the McDonald's and all of that. But slow food is the kind of food system that we're trying to make sure that stays a part of our culinary foodscape.
And we got a caller, Dr. Ridgely.
Dr. Ridgely may have accidentally muted himself.
No, what happened was, now this is Dr. Ridgely. I'm on Sister Ann's phone. My phone battery died before I could plug it back in. I was walking back to the bedroom to plug it in, and it died on the way to the bedroom. So that's where my plug is at. And Sister Ann had hers on, so I came in through Sister Ann on her phone. So we just have a few minutes left, but I think that this whole thing about us relearning how to cook even it's important, because you know when I was coming up, Brother Eric, I'm a few years older than you. You know they used to have home economics in the high school.
Yes, we had it in my high school. I think I might have been the last class that had it in '88.
So they used to have that, but now the children come out of high school, they don't know how to do nothing. We used to have home economics. Used to have shop. You know what I'm talking about? And
yes.
So auto mechanics, all that type of stuff was in high school. But now they come out,
yeah,
they don't know how to do nothing except sell dope and sell their bodies,
yes,
and it's all been a plan.
Yeah, we even had driver's ed in my high school.
Yep.
Yeah.
So they wiped out, first thing they wiped out was farming, was the vocational agriculture. They knocked that out first, and then after they knocked out vocational agriculture in the late 60s, early 70s, they eventually knocked out everything, okay, so that the people are not trained how to do anything, and they wind up having to work at McDonald's or sell drugs or to go to college. And then when they go to college, when they get out of college, they can't find a job locally, and they wind up going all over the country from one place to the next, and sometimes out the country, to be able to get a job with an education that they got. And so it was all a plan, and now we have to plan and put things together again. And we got people like you and other folks we've had on the program who are doing that. We're trying to put this Humpty Dumpty back again so we can survive as a group, as the economy is falling apart. So thank you so much, Brother Eric. Any way for them to contact you?
Yes. Please feel free to contact me at my email address is West Georgia, both words, West Georgia Farmers Co-op, just like Coop, @gmail.com. You can contact me there via Facebook, West Georgia Farmers Cooperative, and you can leave a message on any of those platforms. And when you go to either of those platforms, there's a contact number that will allow you to reach me. So just feel free to reach out. And either one of you. Yeah, West Georgia Farmers Co-op @gmail.com. And Dr. Ridgely, you and Carlton, you all both have my personal contact information, so y'all can contact me through those means. But everybody else is on the channel, WestGeorgiaFarmersCoop @gmail.com. And you can also go to the Facebook page, which is West Georgia Farmers Cooperative, and you can message me there. And there's a phone number on that page that will also allow you to reach me directly.
Okay. Thank you, brother.
Yeah, thank y'all. This is fun, always.
So I try hard to mend the pieces of my broken heart. And I've been all so many nights just feeling sorry for myself. I used to cry. But now I hope.